sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the first part of a recent discussion by physicist Jeff Fair, one of the scientists who found thermite in the World Trade Center dust. And for those of you who are new to the scientific evidence surrounding the collapse of the three World Trade Center buildings, thermite is a highly explosive material. He discusses in depth his process of discovery using the scientific method. He's one of the experts who will appear in the Architects and Engineers' upcoming documentary called 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out. That'll be followed by a 9/11 song, and then you'll hear a local engineer's thoughts on 9/11, and then I'm going to tell you about our progressive movie night coming up on Wednesday, December 8th. That'll be at the University of Hartford in the Wild Auditorium at 7 p.m., so stay tuned. And now here's physicist Jeff Fair.
My name is Jeff Fair. I have a PhD in material science and engineering from the University of Minnesota. I have a BA in physics from Brigham Young University. I've worked with solid-state reactions. I've worked characterizing materials, semiconductor materials, thin films. Currently do a lot of work with nanoparticles as well as solid-state reactions. The way I got involved in 9/11 research was about in 2005. I had read Steve Jones' paper, his initial paper on why the buildings collapsed that day. To give you a little background, on September 11th, I was actually in Albuquerque. I had an appointment at Sandia National Lab, which is part of Kirtland Air Force Base. And that morning, a colleague of mine knocked on the door and said, as I was getting ready, he said, a plane just flew into one of the Trade Center towers. And I thought, that's strange. And continued to get ready for our appointment. A little while later, he came back and said a second plane flew into the towers, and then I thought, okay, this is not just your ordinary news day. Something's going on. So I went out to the lobby of the hotel, and people were watching the news. We all watched what happened. Obviously, the base, Sandia is part of Kirtland Air Force Base, so we knew that we weren't going to be getting on the base that day, and sure enough, the base had locked down. No civilians were going in. So we got a car and drove back to Salt Lake City. So the news of, or the remainder of that day is a little hazy for me because I wasn't sitting in front of the TV watching the news. And I wasn't aware of Building 7 until I read Steve Jones' paper in 2005, which talks about Building 7, talks about the strange details and evidences of surrounding Building 7. And that's what really grabbed my attention and made me want to look more into this. So I actually looked for Steve Jones, and I sought him out, and we talked for a little bit. I wanted to get a feel for his sincerity and his motivation for doing this, and so we talked a little bit. And then I watched one of his talks that he gave in September of 2005 at Brigham Young University, and we talked some more. And at that time, I was working as an electron microscopist. I was characterizing materials, and I thought that I might have something to offer if eventually he was to come across some evidence or evidence was sent to him. And so I offered what I could do to study that, to get some data on any of the evidence that he might collect. So eventually he was able to get some metal samples that were from some of the steel beams from one of the towers. And we studied those. I cut up some of those steel samples and polished them to see what we would find in the steel. Some of the pieces that he acquired at the time had some corrosion. They'd obviously gone through some melting, and we thought that those might be significant. So we actually were looking, and I was going in that direction. That's sort of my expertise, solid-state reactions. That's not quite solid-state necessarily, but that's certainly in the realm of my expertise. So that's the direction that I wanted to go, was to look at these materials, study the phases, and maybe see what temperatures that these phases would have to, or the temperatures that the steel would have to get to create these phases. And then around 2006, I believe it was, Steve started receiving dust samples and started looking at these dust samples. So the study of the metal samples turned up different phases. I did obviously see the steel phase and iron oxide phases. We did find an iron sulfide phase as well as an iron silicate phase. Looking at all the phases, I came to the conclusion that in order to create these phases, we'd have to reach a minimum of about 1100 degrees C. So that was some preliminary work that we did with these steel samples that, or the steel evidence that Steve was able to get from various people. In fact, one of the samples came from Clarkson University. Some of the steel beams had been sent out to Clarkson College, and they were going to build a monument with these, and there was a lot of debris that was sent with the beams, and some of that evidence came from that debris as well as coming directly off of the steel columns. So that's where these initial samples came from. Obviously, it required polishing these pieces of steel and then putting them in the electron microscope to find, and using X-ray analysis to find the chemistry. I used diffraction to determine the phase or the structure of the phases along with the chemistry. And then in that way, we were able to determine the phases that were in the steel or in these pieces of steel that had been corroded or melted, whatever the process they had gone through. That's what we were trying to determine by looking at the phases. So again, we found that the phases that were there probably would require about 1100 degrees C. And that didn't entirely wrap up that part of the study, but that was pretty significant findings. So the question became, how do you get to those temperatures? Obviously, the question of how do you get to 1100 degrees C is significant, because you don't get to those temperatures with scattered office fires or even jet fuel-fed office fires. You get to maybe half that temperature. So that question of how do we get to 1100 degrees C, that became fairly important to me and one of the things that obviously made me more motivated to look further into this. I don't know that I could really speculate as to, I mean, there's any number of sources of heat that could create that temperature, but certainly not jet fuel burning in open air in an office. I guess what makes these findings significant is, well, it's sort of the manner in which we found them. The morphology, in other words, of the grains of these phases, you don't get these phases with an oxyacetylene torch or whatever torch you use to cut the steel. You don't get these phases existing together the way that we found them. So it's, I don't know, I mean, yeah, people might say, well, they cut up the steel, couldn't you create phases with a torch? Yeah, you probably could. I'm not going to deny that. If that ends that investigation, then I think what has to happen is you have to be able to take a torch and show that you can create these phases. And so far, nobody's done that. So I don't know, you know, I'm not going to say that you can't do that. We did find small amounts of aluminum in some of the specimens. More significant probably was the sulfur content that we found. In fact, in one piece, I found a pore in the steel that had pure sulfur embedded in the pore, which I thought was very strange. So that's when I really started looking for sulfur and finding it in more abundance in some of these phases. So then, of course, the next question is, how do you get the sulfur in these pieces of steel or in the debris? And that question is unanswered. There are possibilities for sulfur, I mean, any number of possibilities. There's a version of thermite called thermate, which has sulfur in the thermate. What the sulfur does is it's sort of like salt on ice. It creates eutectic temperature, so it lowers the melting point of steel, and in that way the thermate can cut through the steel or melt the steel more quickly than regular thermite. The finding of aluminum in these steel samples, or what used to be steel samples, also supports the theory that thermite was used to melt the steel. I would certainly love to get an official sample of the steel. that we know came from a large piece of the steel. This was actually done by Jonathan Barnett. He was contracted with FEMA or by FEMA to do this, and he actually took some of the steel members and cut them up, and he selected some very significant pieces of steel. He found ones that had oxidation or sulfatization of the steel members. Some of them looked like they'd been vaporized, certainly melted, and he cut up portions of that steel at that point or at the locations where he saw the sulfatization. And he found similar things. He found iron sulfide in one phase. He found that the sulfur phases, or the phases rich in sulfur, were attacking the grain boundaries of the steel, which is exactly what thermate would do. It would go into the grain boundaries first to attack the steel and then melt the steel as it did that, create that eutectic temperature. His findings were significant in that he originally started with steel from Building 7, and his question was then, do we find the same things happening in steel from buildings 1 and 2, towers 1 and 2? And the answer to that was yes, they found very similar things to what they found in the steel of Building 7. And then the next question was, how much sulfur do you need to create these sulfur phases? He did some preliminary tests, and I think those were significant. And those are some tests that if I had the means, if I had the steel, and the time, I would like to do these tests. How much sulfur do you really need to create these sulfide phases or these sulfur-rich phases? Some people have speculated that the sulfur could have been supplied by the wall board or the gypsum board that was present in the buildings. And I believe that's calcium sulfate, so it is a sulfate-rich phase. However, in order for that to happen, in order for you to get sulfur out of the wall board, you've got to heat up the gypsum board to high enough temperatures to dissociate the calcium from the sulfur. And then you'd have free sulfur and be able to, and then the sulfur could then attack the iron phase or the steel and create these sulfide phases which go into the grain boundaries. But again, you've got to get extremely high temperatures to dissociate those two things. And then you'd have the temperature, and then certainly if you've got those temperatures, you've got the temperature to melt the steel. So this would require high temperatures, certainly higher temperatures than you get in normal office fires. So this is impossible to achieve in a normal office fire, even a jet fuel-fed office fire. You wouldn't achieve the temperatures required to dissociate the calcium and the sulfur in order for the sulfur to then attack the grain boundaries of the steel and melt the steel. So this is probably one of the reasons they use wallboard, is that it's not going to dissociate in normal office fires and attack steel members that are part of steel frame structures. So this is certainly an experiment that could be done to see if you get the sulfatization and this attacking of the steel member by wallboard, by just putting the two together in high temperatures. Certainly an experiment that could be done, something that debunkers could easily do. I don't know why it hasn't been done, although I can speculate that it doesn't work. So we use wallboard to protect the steel. Historically, this has never been a problem, that wallboard dissociates and you have a lot of sulfur in fires attacking steel members. So a wallboard is actually there to protect the steel. So Jonathan Barnett's study, which I thought was very well done and quite extensive, is all documented by FEMA in Appendix C in their BPAT report that was May of 2002. Unfortunately, it was never used in the NIST report, and it wasn't really used in the explanation for how the buildings fell in the FEMA report either. So it seems that although the report was done, and it was very well done, it was never really used by the report to explain or should I say that the questions that they brought up in that report, which are, how do you get that much, where did the sulfur come from? How much sulfur do you need to create these phases? And how do you get the temperatures required to create the phases? I believe in the report, they put a minimum temperature of 940 degrees C to create the phases, and that's at the eutectic. So those questions were never addressed by either the report, or either by Jonathan Barnett's report, or by the FEMA report itself, or by the NIST report. These questions were never addressed. And I think they're significant because you've got this evidence here. How do you get those temperatures? Where do you get the sulfur? These are things that we should be asking and people should be investigating. So around in 2006, Steve Jones was working on some other evidence that he had acquired, which was dust evidence. And one of the things that he was doing was going through that dust with a magnet and finding spheres, microspheres, whatever you want to call them, and looking at those spheres and trying to get the composition of those spheres. It's a difficult task at best to try and determine the composition of these spheres, because in order to get the internal composition, you've got to somehow break these open. And fortunately, he was able to find some that were actually broken open. At this time, Steve was working with a student at Brigham Young University, a BYU student, a physics student, and Daniel Farnsworth is his name. And together, they were working on the electron microscope and using X-ray analysis to try and determine the chemistry of these microspheres. To be honest, when Steve told me he was looking through the dust, through these dust samples, I thought this was a fool's errand. I just thought, this is a needle in a haystack. I didn't really think that they'd find anything significant, to be honest. I really didn't. So I stuck with working on these steel samples, which I thought were significant, and I still do. Eventually, Steve came to me and said, we're finding these red-gray chips. And I really didn't think anything of it. They could have been anything. The significant thing about the red-gray chips was not just the frequency in which they were finding them, but also they were attracted by a magnet, which was his method for pulling out these spheres. So he was pulling out the spheres as well as the red-gray chips. And so he came to me and said, we're getting some interesting compositional analysis from the red layer of these red-gray chips. We're actually seeing peaks of aluminum, as well as other things, but the aluminum peak was significant. So he'd find these aluminum peaks, and as well as iron peaks and oxygen peaks and various other peaks, but the aluminum and the iron and the oxygen together were very significant, because this is your composition for thermite. So that's when I started to get a little bit more interested in the dust and get more interested in these red-gray chips. But I didn't really start working on these red-gray chips, and Steve and Daniel were continuing to find things about the chips, and they would bring that information to me. And eventually I said, okay, I remember we were sitting in my office and he was talking about the red-gray chips, and I thought, okay, if you really want to see if these red-gray chips are significant, what we could do is take one of these chips and put it in a calorimeter and see if they're energetic. And at that point, Steve was saying, well, how do we find a calorimeter? Who's got a calorimeter? So I found a lab that had a calorimeter that we could use. It's a DSC, differential scanning calorimeter, and learned quickly how to use the calorimeter and how to calibrate it and make sure that we were doing everything properly. I actually had somebody that really uses it a lot there with me as I conducted these experiments. So we put one of the larger chips that we had into the calorimeter and let it run to see what would happen. And that was really a turning point for the red-gray chips for me, because we got a peak on the calorimeter which shows that these red-gray chips were energetic. They were putting out more energy and they were very exothermic. And the width of the peak was also significant, because it showed the power that the chips had, and that was really the turning point for the red-gray chips. And that's when I got very interested in the red-gray chips and joined them in their study of the red-gray chips and really took off with that. So the significance of the calorimeter cannot be understated here. The calorimeter can't lie to you. If that thing pops off, if you get a sharp peak in the calorimeter, that material is energetic. And the degree of its energy is determined by the height of the peak, and the power at which it goes off is the width of the peak. But we were finding very narrow peaks and very high peaks in the calorimeter, which showed that this very, very small chip had a lot of energy packed into it, more than you would find in everyday materials at the office. And certainly, the number of chips that they were finding in these random dust samples made the fact that they were present there in such quantity also made them significant. So it certainly wasn't an anomaly, because we were getting multiple dust samples from multiple individuals who had no connection with each other, had no connection to Steve or myself, and they're sending us these dust samples, and every one of the dust samples was showing red-gray chips. And they were striking in their similarity. The paper that we wrote about the red-gray chips, you can actually see, we've taken photographs of these red-gray chips to show these things are so similar. we couldn't ignore these red gray chips any longer. And that's where the paper really took off. That's where the data for the paper really took off.
That was the first part of a recent discussion by physicist Jeff Ferrer. Tune in next week to hear the concluding segment of that discussion. And now here's the song. It starts out with the reporter talking about the Salomon Brothers building, which was World Trade Center Building 7, the third building to collapse on 9/11, and it was not hit by a plane.
The Salomon Brothers building collapsing, and indeed it has.
There's a million reasons why I don't believe it. There's a million reasons why it can't be true. Open fire can't melt steel. It's not hot enough. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the Reichstag, Germany. There's a million questions still. Like the towers, it just fell. The fire's not enough. No way hot enough to bring it down. The project for the new American century was added to a year before that day. It stakes in order to proceed. A modern day Pearl Harbor it would need.
The Gulf of Tonkin took the bay.
9/11 set them free. The project for the new American century.
They made that decision to pull, then we watched the building collapse.
Our civil rights have disappeared. A global fascist state draws near. And our freedom slips away. And they don't give a star.
Now you're going to hear a local engineer's opinions on 9/11. This was recorded at the Hope Out Loud Peace Festival in Bushnell Park in Hartford on September 19th, 2010.
Okay, so I'm here in Bushnell Park, and I'm interviewing passersby on their thoughts on 9/11, and I find the crowd very educated and compared to former years on 9/11. Right now we're here with someone, a gentleman, and he's going to tell us a little bit about himself and what he thinks about 9/11.
Hi, my name is Vinny from Wallingford, Connecticut. I recently joined AE911Truth.org, which is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I'm an engineer myself, and I came here today just to... I'd never been to Hope Out Loud, and I've heard about it on the 9/11 wake-up call program, so I wanted to come out and see what was going on and just support what's been going on around here. Since 9/11 happened, it's changed my life a lot, and I have no family members or friends who were killed, but just witnessing all the devastation, it really made me want to know what really was going on, and it bothered me for many years, and I find it very suspicious the events that happened and the people behind them and how it's been covered up and how the reports haven't even mentioned, like, Building 7 coming down, which was the building that you don't see much on the news at all. They showed too many times, you know, airplanes hitting the Twin Towers, but Building 7 at WTC area was taken down at 5 o'clock approximately that day, which had government agencies inside it, and it came down at freefall speed. So someone like me who studied physics takes a look at that and really, you know, I question what the heck was that all about? How could that have happened? And it's obvious to me that, you know, this whole 9/11 was another incidence of, you know, Pearl Harbor to get us involved in a war. And that was the only way to get us involved because we didn't want to be in it. And now we're spending millions on it. And it's a mess. And people need to know about it more and be, you know, raise their awareness about it.
So would you say one of the best ways to stop the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq would be to expose the truth about 9/11?
Yeah, absolutely, because right now the majority of the people in our country and even, you know, globally, I think they just buy what they see on mainstream media. That's their source of information, and they use that and say, hey, that's what's going on here. But there's a lot that you don't get to see, and the stories are spun in such a way that certain things aren't even told. So people will say, well, you're just being a conspiracy theorist. But in fact, there is a conspiracy that was going on, because if you were to use, you know, the scientific method to deconstruct what actually happened, you'll see very clearly that what happened cannot have happened by airplanes hitting buildings, and how this Building 7, the 42nd story skyrise, how it came down like it did, couldn't have happened, you know, without the use of explosives. And now there's reports from AE-911 finding nanothermite particles, lots of evidence of that, which is a type of explosive that burns right through steel. It's absolutely incredible, and it's something that more people need to learn about, because I think a lot of the news stations are funded, you know, by our government and regulated by the FCC, so they can't say more than what they're allowed to, and they want to keep instilling fear about the terrorists. The fact is, I think people need to realize that it's, you know, it all started here, not over there, and the whole idea about bringing Muslims into this and all this about building a mosque and everything you hear about today, it's all just a big diversion that they love to do to keep you occupied, to keep you from asking the big questions. So I really want to see an investigation, and that's why I donated to AE-911. That's why I joined, because I really want to see an investigation into what happened, and I want the questions answered, because they've avoided them for too long now, the really important questions about what happened that day at 9/11.
Great, thank you.
And now for our progressive movie night. We'll be showing the movie Dark Legacy on Wednesday, December 8th at 7 p.m. at the University of Hartford in the Wild Auditorium. Dark Legacy explores the connections between the JFK assassination and former CIA director and former President George Bush Sr. It's a film not to miss, and again, it'll be shown on Wednesday, December 8th at 7 p.m. on the campus of the University of Hartford in the Wild Auditorium. We'll also be giving out some free DVDs on 9/11 at the movie event, so hope to see you all there. I just finished reading the book JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James Douglas, and I highly recommend it. It's well documented, and it exposes the shadow government, or the deep state, as Peter Dale Scott calls it. There will be copies for sale at the movie night on December 8th. And in closing, there's so much evidence out there that if you're not a conspiracy theorist, you're just not paying attention. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.